everyone. It's Dr. Denise, and this is the Dr. Denise Show. This is the Embrace Your Neurostyle series, and I'm honored to have Lynn Barrett here. She's the author of Crazy, Reclaiming Your Life After Trauma, and also she's a speaker, retreat leader, and survivor of early childhood trauma. And Lynn, I'm just so honored to have you here today.
Thank you, Denise. I'm really honored to be here. I appreciate that you invited me on your show.
Yeah. So first of all, I just want to let you know, I was so honored that this timing of this interview can be on. It's March 5th, 2022. And it's actually, I didn't even know that there was a day. This is like, I'm learning something, that there's a DID day, dissociative identity disorder day, to honor and raise awareness. So I'm wondering if we could jump in and maybe you can educate all of us as to what that is and how that relates to you and your own healing journey.
Well, thank you so much for bringing that up. And I'm so glad that that there is a DID day to help the public understand what dissociative identity disorder is. It's probably the most misunderstood disorder that's out there. And a part of what I am doing by speaking with you and others and by writing my memoir is to help dispel the misunderstandings and to build some knowledge in the general public, as well as among those who have DID, about what this disorder actually is and what causes it and how it's displayed and how it can be healed. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk about some of those things.
Well, one thing that I'm very passionate is the power of the human spirit and how when we go into our own suffering, I feel like for all of us, no matter what our neurostyle is. And by the way, the way I've defined neurostyle is that we all process and perceive things in our own unique way. Mm-hmm. And we're multidimensional beings. There's the biological, psychological, social, cultural, spiritual, then I say sixth sense intuition. And I was able to read parts of your book, but then I thought, Denise, you know what? Let's get to know Lynn. Let's hear her journey and let's get everyone excited about your book. And I want to actually state your book out loud. And that's even its own statement in the universe. Lynn's book is called Crazy, Reclaiming Life from the Shadow of Traumatic Memory, which just came out this year. And then she also has a DID Unpacked, a parable available on Amazon. So you've used writing as a huge healing tool on your journey, right, Lynn?
I have. I absolutely have. And I probably didn't realize that that was what I was doing when I was writing, but it certainly has been a very powerful tool for healing for me. Beginning back in the days when I had no idea what was going on, when I was decompensating, when I was in the midst of pain and unreality and what I call craziness, and writing in a journal. You know, and sometimes it was just scribbles, but still it was just so important for me to write in a journal. And so over the years, you know, I've written in different ways. I've certainly written professionally. I wrote to heal. And after I retired and I was fully integrated, I thought to myself, this is a story that needs to be told. And I also need to make sense of my life. And so it's for those reasons that I started this process of writing my memoir. And
so I want to pause on the power of the written and spoken word. And one of the reasons I want you to know that I have this neurostyle is that it's such a more neutral term, but it doesn't mean I'm an adult and child integrative psychiatrist, that as human beings, we do suffer. So when I'm hearing, you know, DID, the word disorder for me has always been like nails on the chalkboard, but in reality, it validates people's experience when they're suffering. But then that's just there's moments of time where we go from crisis to stabilization to thrive. And I saw in your book, even your own writings in the book about perception and learning how to trust yourself and reintegrate and have reorder instead of that feeling of craziness and disorder.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And interestingly, when you speak of the writing, I wanted to mention that about a year ago, I began these virtual writers' workshops for people with dissociative disorders. And I had no idea what I was doing when I started these. I mean, I knew how to run a writer's workshop. I understood that. So I understood what I was doing technically, but I did not understand what I was doing from a spiritual point of view, because it has been just amazing to watch these amazing, wonderful, brave, courageous people learn to trust themselves and learn to trust each other and learn to trust me to share the most deepest, difficult experiences of their lives. So I wanted to add that as a affirmation of writing as a tool for healing. And certainly that may not be true for everyone. Everyone has, as you said, we all have our own neurostyles, but that's a pretty powerful one. And it's one that I'm realizing more and more that people who are suffering can utilize that so well to help them through the worst of the times that they're in.
So can you take us on your journey of when you first had your diagnosis and maybe some myth busters around dissociative identity disorder? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, it depends on the generation you're in. You know, people have different levels of trauma. I mean, the earth, we're in a very high level of trauma coming off of COVID. We've got the war in Ukraine, but then people are just fighting sometimes one day at a time if they've had early childhood trauma. So can you just give us a window into your journey of realizing you were having dissociative episodes and then your diagnosis, just to give us a window into this path that you've been on of healing?
Sure. So I didn't know what dissociation was when this started. I had no idea. I was a happy wife and mother of four children, and I thought I had created a really lovely life. Although I will say that as an adolescent, I had this strong feeling that I was defective and that there was something wrong with me, and yet I sort of plugged away to create a life that was satisfying and fulfilling. And then in the midst of that wonderful life, I started to decompensate. Everything just started to peel away, and my sense of reality really changed and to some extent disappeared. So I was
specific trigger, or was it a time in your life where multiple stressors were happening when this bubbled up?
Well, that's a good question. There was a trigger. However, I want to say, so there was a 10-year period where that was the real crazy period. It was when I started to lose my grip and when I was diagnosed. That was a 10-year period. And initially, that just was, it was happening without the trigger. You know, there was no trigger at that point. And so sometimes people with DID don't have to have a trigger to get it, to have the parts come forward and to start to experience the sense of unreality. But in my case, I found out that my husband had been having an affair. And that just accelerated what had already begun. Let me explain to you what some of my symptoms were. I've already discussed the sense of unreality, but I can't emphasize that enough. Sometimes I felt like I was sitting in the corner of the ceiling, looking down, watching this wretched woman going through life.
Can I tell you right now, as you're talking, I'm putting my hand on my heart, and my sensory awareness is that I'm here listening to you. But the minute you said your unreality, I got the word floating, and I saw you like floating. It was like how to stay grounded on earth.
I was floating, and it wasn't a lovely floating. I mean, there are images of floating that can be beautiful and supportive, but this was a frightening and scary floating that I wasn't who I thought I was. I had multiple strands of thought going through my head at one time. I had feelings of doom, of terror, of fear. I was experiencing suicidal ideation almost all of the time. I would often crawl up into bed and just take a fetal position because I was in so much psychic pain. I actually did attempt suicide once. Fortunately, I'm so grateful that I was not successful. And that was part of, I didn't understand it at the time, but that was actually part of this disorder because parts of me wanted to die more than anything else in the world. But I had other parts that wanted to live. And so
Lynn,
the person wanted to live, you know.
I'm here listening to your words. And I just want to offer gratitude and compassion that in this moment you're sharing your story.
Yes.
So thank you. Because a lot of times people, they're at different levels of trauma, whether it's with dissociative identity disorder, DID, PTSD, depression, bipolar, ADHD, and people are at different levels of suffering. And I don't know for you, when you talk about this now and as you're healing and writing, do you have a way going into an interview to kind of elevate and protect yourself when you talk about the trauma? Because I know for some people in my practice, you know, I always give, like when I'm working with people, I like to give people permission to have a sense of control. I know you agreed to this interview, but how is it for you right now talking about this?
Denise, it's actually really fine. I'm actually 20 years past integration, and I think that it was wise for me to wait that long before I would write this memoir, because it gave me, not only had I been through the bulk of my healing, but that time and space gave me more perspective so that I could write the book in such a way that it would be meaningful to people, to the general public, because I had enough distance and space. So I have become quite comfortable with speaking about this. However, having said that, I am 74 years old, and I am only coming out now. I have never told people about this before because it is such a misunderstood disorder. And I was afraid that, you know, I might lose my job. I was afraid from the messages from the past that told me that you were going to get in really big trouble if you told. So I never talked about this before, and I would have been terrified to do that. But I'm 74, and when you get to my age, you know, you sort of, you get to the point where you say, this is who I am. And this is the gift that's been given to me to share back. And I don't have to worry about that now. I'm retired. I have a wonderful, loving husband. I have a really good family, and I have friends. And so
I want to just interject. There was a part in the book where you did share it with one of your cohorts when you were teaching.
Yes, I did.
Was it Phyllis?
Well, the name that I used.
I
believe it was Karen. Yeah.
Okay. If you change the names, but wait though, this is very important because a part of like embrace your neurostyle, and one of my mission statements is to change the way we think, talk, and act about mental health. And the fact that you just shared, I'm this age, and now I'm, you know, I don't feel like I'm going to lose my job, or I feel very integrated. A lot of people still live in fear day to day that someone's going to find out they have DID, they have PTSD,
Absolutely.
They have anxiety, because there's a lot of myth busters of people can be highly functioning on the outside, but then the inside suffering, it's an invisible suffering. So I thank you for this book. And I mean, you did share with some people, and how did you process when you did share with some people and deciding who it was safe to share with and how to even trust?
That was really only one person that I shared with. I was a teacher, and it was a fellow teacher. And for some reason, I felt like I just needed for someone in my school to know about this, because I was sort of overwhelmed with the knowledge of it. And as soon as I shared, I got huge internal backlash. I was terrified. I went home and called my therapist. I went on for months being absolutely positive that I was going to die because of this. And I know that sounds a little bit dramatic, but that's the kind of feelings that we have. They are triggers from the past that if I tell, I'm going to die. And so I didn't die, and nothing terrible came out of that particular sharing. But I did learn that I need to be really careful about sharing. So you can see it's a huge jump, isn't it, from back then to now, when I'm really fine about sharing. And I'm just so grateful for that, because I think in my ability to share that I can be of help to other people who have DID, and to the general public who really is confused about what this disorder is all about.
Well, can you describe from your perspective what DID is? I know you were describing your experience of unreal feelings, and I can put the link in the DSM, but I feel like your perspective is so rich, so unique, because you've gone through your process of ascension and healing. How would you describe DID to the audience?
Well, thank you for asking that question. I'll describe dissociation first. Dissociation is something that everybody does sometimes. It is really sort of a temporary split between the mind and the body. So if you're sitting in a lecture hall listening to a really boring professor and you're right by the window and there are children playing soccer out there, you know, your mind leaves your body in this lecture hall, and it's out there on the field watching the kids playing soccer and having such a good time. That's a very basic form of dissociation where the body and the mind separate temporarily. But because of that separation, dissociation can be a protective a strategy as well, so that a soldier on the battlefield might dissociate in order to survive the horrors that he's experiencing. And then even when he comes home, that dissociation may come back off and on for him because it was such a horrible experience. The same is true for a woman who has been raped. She may dissociate during the experience, and then that may come back to her off and on after the rape. So dissociation protects you from taking in the full horror of what is happening to you. Now, when a small child is chronically traumatized or abused, and often by the people who are caring for the child, so the child has to rely on this person. Because a child can't take care of themselves. So what the child does, our brains are still developing when we're little, and the child dissociates. If it's once and done trauma, you know, it may have a real impact on the child, but it won't cause dissociative identity disorder. What causes dissociative identity disorder is when it happens over and over and over again, so that the brain starts to develop around these experiences or emotions or events in the child's life to protect a part of the child, so the child can go back out there, not know anything about the abuse, and be with the person who abuses them without any knowledge of that abuse, because that is protective and that is functional in the moment. Now, when the child grows up, it's no longer functional because the child is no longer in danger and doesn't need that protection. And because these parts that we've created start to create havoc in our psyches. Now, for quite a while, I mean, for everyone, it's different. People will start to experience their parts in adolescence or as late as in their seventh decade. So it can start at any time.
I want to say that I feel like this specific disorder is also one where there's been a lot of fear, because there was the show Sybil. And even within the medical community, there's a lot of controversy around this specific disorder. And by the way, it affects 2% of the population, which that's a lot. And that means a lot of people are probably having symptoms of dissociation that are more severe than they even realize. And I'm looking that, you know, 90% of the cases, as you mentioned, it has to do with child abuse or neglect. Or there's also cases, like you mentioned, experiencing post-traumatic and dissociative issues with war, medical procedures. I have had, Lynn, just so you know, someone that had so many medical procedures, a couple of my clients, that they had dissociative identity around that and going to see the doctor and what that means, because yes, they had so much illness and so many procedures and they felt so violated. It's a huge violation in your mind, body, and soul. And usually it's because of, like you mentioned, someone close to someone. It's more the profile of a sexual abuse. But I think the other myth busting is that you can have dissociative identity disorders that coincide with other triggers. And most mental health and psychiatric, for me, just so you know, it's ironic that I'm an MD and that the word disorder is nailed. Like, I value and I honor science. And I know that the word disorder is needed for medical terms. I want you to know this about me. But when I work with my clients, I think of them as their name and I listen to their target symptoms and I help them to reintegrate. And the power of the words we tell ourselves when we're healing are so important. So I just wanted to let you know that, because I think there's so much shame. There's so much in even the word disorder. It makes someone feel like, how can I do my day? So I just want to say thank you. Keep going. But I feel like there's so much like myth busting to do around DID.
Yeah. And to be honest, many of us do not consider it a disorder. We consider it a coping strategy.
Go ding, 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 ding? I'm just getting chills because the word, I want to just say this. Thank you, science, that we have ways of talking about things. But everything about how I've always practiced medicine and psychiatry before I ever launched this brand or the show was, how do we accept and love ourselves? It all starts with awareness, self-love. And then if we're blessed, you know, altruism, giving back, like you're giving back your knowledge and wisdom by doing these writer's workshops, by doing this book. And it is a coping strategy because you're traveling outside of your body because the trauma was so much that when you have the trigger, it's so painful, it's hard to stay on earth.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that you also brought up another myth. You said 2% of the population worldwide has DID. And I've heard anywhere from 1 to 5%. So 2 is right in the middle of it. One of the reasons why they don't know the exact number is because it is because most people with DID are in the system for like 6 to 10 years before they're accurately diagnosed. That was certainly true for me. I was 10 years in the system.
I want to just talk about professionals don't often have the level of training, because I remember when I had someone that came to see me that had such severe childhood sexual abuse. I have had one situation, by the way, I've been in practice for 21 years, 40,000 hours of clinical. So I've got a lot of expertise, but a lot of times out in the world of outpatient mental health and MDs, I mean, I think people, can you coach people on if they're having dissociative symptoms or PTSD, what to ask your therapist or what to ask your MD so you can get the right care quicker?
Well, that's a good question. And what I say to people, so if, number one, there is no medication that treats DID. Now, sometimes people with DID have auxiliary or secondary diagnoses that do need medication, for instance, depression or anxiety, but DID itself is not treated by medication. The other thing that I want to say about looking for a therapist that will be trauma-informed and helpful for you in your healing is someone who is, number one, willing to work with your parts, and someone who's willing to welcome them and believe them. Those are the things that were the most important for me, and I was very fortunate. I just sort of accidentally stumbled onto a therapist who it was exactly that. And I wasn't looking for that because I didn't really know what I had. I was still in a fog and I was totally unsure of what I needed, but I just needed, I knew I needed another therapist. And I have to say, I had alters that would come and meet her in the therapy room and they would be angry and loaded for bear. And she would say, "Welcome. I'm so glad you're here. You're safe now. I hope you come back again." I mean, she would say those things to me whenever, and no matter how nasty an alter would be, because some of them are a little nasty because they're pretty darn angry about what happened to them. And whenever she would do that, she would like, it would take the steam out of the alter's anger. And it doesn't mean that the anger all went away immediately, but it means that they were able to start to trust her and to work through whatever issues they brought to the table.
So I am not an expert in DID, but I am an adult and child board certified psychiatrist. And I have had people that came to me that had DID, and at the time it was called multiple personality disorder.
Right. That's how I diagnosed actually.
Yes. And so what I want to say to your exact moment in time that you just shared with all of us is I think when you're going to see your therapist, your MD, your spiritual advisor, you want to make sure there's a therapeutic alliance and that they've created a safe and sacred space. So right when you just shared that, and you were talking about your alters, which were the different, which people can get your book to really go deep dive on that. I got "you're safe, you're safe, you're safe." So it seemed like your therapist created a word or something that was almost like a reminding of how to integrate or how to tolerate even getting through a therapy appointment.
That's exactly right. Yes.
So that's very important when we're going to get help, that we have that level of safety. And I encourage people, when you're shopping for the right MD, the right therapist, not only look at their resume, but talk to them on the phone. See if they'll give you some time. Our own intuition, even when we're learning how to trust ourselves, when we're in trauma or suffering, our own inner voice can tell us, okay, I want to try this person. So it sounds like, by the way, your therapist, I did read the part where your therapist was moving from one office to the next and your alters were not happy with that.
That is correct.
So that session was kind of a quiet session, right?
It was very quiet. I just sat there. I couldn't talk. You know, I was so, having all these thoughts in my head, like, how could she do this? Didn't she know this would affect me? You know, and she didn't even tell me much in advance. I hardly knew that this was going to happen. And so there was all this internal, you know, dialogue, and I wouldn't say a word. And she just sat there and she just looked at me with a smile on her face and she just waited. I went through the whole session, never said a word, and I got up at the end. And then when I got up, the other parts of me said, "How could you do that? We had so many things to talk about with her." Yeah. So it was just so funny. And I mean, in looking back at it, it wasn't funny at the time.
So for your personal story of this amazing journey of healing, getting the proper diagnosis, you were a mother with four children, you've had so much success in your professional life. What was your healing journey like? How many, for people that are faced with any sort of childhood trauma or trauma that's really severe and there are different levels of healing, for you, how many years, like when was your ding, 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 where you started to be more fully integrated and started to trust again? What was that like for you?
It was this very slow process. And the most important person I needed to learn to trust was myself. And to trust that I needed to learn how to manage triggers, because triggers just, you know, blew me apart and made me respond in ways that would not be really helpful.
Can you give an example of what some of your triggers were? Or maybe they still are, but you know how to gracefully navigate them?
Well, I do occasionally get a trigger now, but not very often. A trigger could be anything that reminds me of the past, and it could be somebody could say something to me in a negative way, and I could blow it up into like, this is the end of the world, and they're going to hate me, or I'm going to lose my job, or I'm stupid, I'm weak. And I would go into these emotions and these feelings that were, if I acted on them, I would certainly sabotage myself. And so instead of saying to myself, oh, well, she's in a bad mood today, you know, or, oh, I think this person is a little jealous of me right now. You know, I mean, I couldn't do those things because I was so filled with this overwhelming emotion. And it would be also in my body. My whole body would ache and be in pain. And I would feel terror because I would be afraid that I was going to be hurt. And so that took,
can I just say something? I feel like our body, mind, and soul, when we look at that, there's times where when you think about fight or flight, there's times when we get a trigger and it's actually a protective mechanism. So we don't get into that relationship or we don't make that call. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you're learning how to reintegrate for any type of trauma, you're learning not only to trust yourself, but you're learning to also accept that there's parts of the physiological experience your body or your mind has that can also be protective. So you can go, whoa, wait a second. Someone's talking to me like that. That's a pink flag. I don't think I want to work with them, or, huh, I don't really want this relationship. And sometimes when people are in early stages of their healing process, they just want to shut the door to everyone. They don't want to trust anyone.
Exactly. Yes.
So I feel like there's like, it's so, the linear language sometimes is so precise that healing, integrating, having your best day comes with lots of moments of crisis stabilization and thrive throughout our days. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I just think that it's certainly true that we have times when we're going through this healing process, it is learning how to trust our gut. Because I always discovered that the thing that triggered me had reality, that there was something real about it, but that my emotions were way over the top. So what you're saying is you need to start to trust your gut and to trust your intuition, but in that pink zone, not the red zone. You know, the red zone is the trigger that is, you know, overwhelming. And that's real for you in the moment, but to know that the amount of emotion that you're feeling, the amount of pain you're feeling is not warranted for what happened. But you're right. Sometimes you have to trust yourself that, I want good people in my life. I want people I can trust in my life. I want to make good choices. And the things that tend to trigger us also tend to be good information, as long as we can bring it out of the red zone and back down into the pink or the yellow zone, you know?
Yes. So what was the specific type of therapy that your therapist utilized? Or sometimes there's multiple modalities of therapy.
I didn't know what it was at all. She was British and she was trained in a psychoanalytic style. And so I think that was what her modality was. I didn't do anything with EMDR, which is it's not new, but it was new compared to my age back then. I do understand that can be a very helpful therapeutic approach for some people.
Now, and I'm sure that there's within the national NAMI, the National Alliance for Mentally Ill, I think I'd like to also say to people, no matter where you are in the world, if you've had severe trauma, not only talk to your primary care doctor, but do a deep dive on your mental health organizations and see people who have had a level of expertise with DID. I think asking those right questions and having something when you're on your journey of healing. Did you do that, or were you just kind of very fortunate to find your therapist?
I was very fortunate because I didn't know. At that time, I had no memories whatsoever. I just thought I was crazy. And, you know, but the weird thing is that one of the definitions of crazy is that you don't know that you're crazy, but I knew I was, you know, I knew what I should be doing, but wasn't doing because I wasn't capable of, in that moment. So,
So that what you just said is really powerful. And I feel like I was thinking about that, like, oh my goodness, I get to meet Lynn today. We could probably do five shows. I'm like, Denise, you can't do five shows. But what I was thinking is your giftedness. And for people, when you're on your healing journey, I say the multiple, we have a multi-sensory healing experience. So for specifically with DID, we talked about the importance of finding the right therapist. If you are diagnosed with multiple other, she mentioned comorbidities. People can have PTSD, generalized anxiety, depression. So oftentimes mental health challenges or disorders, which I don't like everyone, that's why I say neurostyle, right. But we can just use different words. They often come in clusters. So getting the right diagnosis, the right treatment, making sure you have your physical, that you're really handling things from a mind, body, soul for healing. But Lynn, I'd like to really elevate right here as we're doing this later part of this interview, the power of your written word and that you're writing. Your ascension into your own healing really included a lot of your own personal writing in your own healing work. Can you tell everyone just about that journey and then how people could work with you now?
Sure. I started writing as I said before, I waited until I was a good distance away from integration before I wrote, before I began the memoir. However, I had been writing and journaling for many, many years prior to that. And I have a plastic container that is filled with about 50 journals I was able to draw on when I wrote my memoir. So it was really good to go back and remember things that I hadn't remembered, but because it was in black and white there. I started writing, I would say it took me about 3 years to write. Just before I retired, and it took about, I put it down for a while and then I picked it back up. And I would say altogether, it was probably about 3 years. I have felt writing has been critical because in DID, what it does is it helps you build communication between yourself and your parts and between your parts. Especially if you're experiencing a good deal of amnesia, your parts can talk to each other and get to know each other through writing because they may not know each other otherwise.
So can you everyone define parts? Because I think, I want it to come from you.
Yes. Well, there's different words we can use. I'm going to say alters, parts, people, persons, insiders. Those are some of the words that I have heard other people with DID use. I usually use the word parts or insiders myself, but I honor whatever words people choose to describe the different aspects of themselves. And these are the parts, the insiders, the alters that were created in childhood, but probably were hidden and operating relatively collaboratively through a part of your life. But then at some point in your life, sometimes it's a trigger that brings them forward, or sometimes it's just that it's just not possible to keep it all in anymore. And so that's what a part is. It's an alternative personality is the technical name.
And I just want to say this. Is it Sophie or Sophia? And what of your alter?
Are we talking about Sylvia?
Is it, which one was the wild one?
Sylvia was the sexual and sensual one.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I just was reading about Sylvia today. And then I have to be really honest with you, confession. When you, at the beginning of the book, when there were 10, I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm going to meet Lynn. How am I going to keep track of all the alters? And I'm like, step away from the concern. This is all about the healing process, the integration. And when I read about Sylvia, that alter seems like she was the one that got you out to do things. So I think when people are in their own healing journey with DID, and you're integrating your alters, they serve different purposes of healing. And I think in your memoir, which I don't want to talk too much more about because I want people to get it, especially if they want to support anyone or if they're having the journey. Would you say though, that did you learn how to not only integrate, but embrace the healing power of what you learned from the alters?
Oh, absolutely. So one of my messages to people with DID or DDNOS, which is a very similar diagnosis to DID, that's dissociative disorder not otherwise specified, is to learn to love your alters, and they're not always lovable, but it's like having real children, isn't it? Real children aren't really lovable all the time, but you love them anyway, and that's how you raise them, and that's what you have to do with your own alters.
I'm smiling because I remember when Kim, who reached out to me to do this interview, who you're working with your book, and she mentioned to you, do you want to do the embrace your neuro style? And you're like, whoa, that sounds a little positive. But I'm just thinking that the word embrace and loving your alters, it is embracing all the different dimensions. How do we have an awareness of all the ways we process and perceive things? And how do we get to that place of self-love even when we're suffering? And I feel like this is what this book has done.
And they are me. And if you have DID, your alters are you. Even though they may not feel like you, or they didn't always feel like me. But I also want to explain that once I integrated, so they're still there. Because
I was just going to ask you about that and go, is Sylvia mad at me that I got the name wrong? And I'm like,
no, not at all. Well, so, I mean, I have to say this is the way it worked for me, and it might work differently for someone else. But in my case, my alters just decided that once they knew each other, shared enough and healed from the abuse that they had experienced, that they actually decided that life would be better if they integrated and let me be the person, you know. But they're not gone. And I have to explain that because when...
Thank you for doing that. I really appreciate that because the linear language, sometimes when we say we're healed or we're cured or we're accepted or we're integrated, doesn't count for the days where we can have many triggers. Like we just discussed, there's like the green zone, yellow, orange, red. And then there's probably different days where you're aware of that part of you. So I'm using different language to broaden the audience. So maybe if you don't have DID, it's not an alter. It doesn't mean if you have depression or ADHD or bipolar or something, you can have moments where you're experiencing your feelings. I think the idea of honoring your feeling states is a very important way to broaden this out.
Absolutely. There's a lot that you can broaden out to people because we all have parts. My parts were created through chronic childhood trauma. Your parts may not have been created in that manner, so they don't have maybe the same intensity as mine, but we all have parts that say, well, I have a part that wants to go dancing tonight, and I have another part that just wants to sit at home and read a book. So we have that's natural and normal for people. And in any case, whatever our diagnosis is, or even if we don't have a diagnosis, but we are struggling, to know that we are worth it, that you are worth it. And to learn to love yourself, whether you're in parts or whether you're whole and unified. And I know when I say that, that's not such an easy thing to do. It took me 20 years to figure out how to do that. But it is possible to know that you're worth it and that you are, that you can take the time to do good things for you. And even to be selfish because,
I want to say something. One of my mission statements this year, I've got three things with all the different shows. And one of them is self-care is the new cool, Lynn. So even the word selfish, right? I mean, what self-preservation, self-care, you know, I think that there's different generational overlays that if we're actually taking care of ourselves, it is selfish. And I think that's another myth buster, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Most of the people that I know with DID, and I know quite a few now through my writer's workshops, are much more likely to, you know, to like bend over backwards to do things for other people and to not take care of themselves. because we were sort of raised that way, that we had to take care of the adults in our lives.
Yes.
And so when I say selfish, it's not that I'm suggesting that we should become a group of selfish people who only think of ourselves, but that we probably thought of ourselves so little in the past, and that's why we're suffering, that if we can, we need to start changing the balance there and move to the other side a little bit and learn that that we are worth it, that we need to start taking care of ourselves, because honestly, if we don't take care of ourselves, it's probably unlikely that someone else will.
I love that you said that. So in the world of development, in when we're children, if we've suffered any sort of trauma and we've had emotional or physical or neglect or sexual abuse, it's like you're doing a reparenting of yourself as an adult, having your own integration. And when we say the word parts, now you've talked about parts with your alters, but there's also the multi-dimensions of the neurostyle, biological, psychological, social, cultural, spiritual, and then intuition, if you believe in the unseen energy. And so when you, like, even, can I just get some feedback? Like today you told me, gosh, I just moved. You gave me, like, before we did our interview, I think it's important, everyone, when you're talking with someone, to do a check-in in the moment of now of the feeling state with yourself and someone else. And I said to Lynn, does this interview work for you today? And you said, yes, let's go for it. But so I think that that was giving a permission in that moment. I do that with my friends with socializing, because sometimes we have a social plan, but we don't know how our day was. Did we have a lot of stress? Do we need to relax tonight instead of go out? And I think a lot of people don't kind of own the moment of now, that it's not only okay to have your feeling, but it's okay to want to have the healthiest decision for you right now. And I think when you've had childhood trauma or DID, it's hard to trust even how to know, well, wait, how am I feeling? Okay, I deserve to have a good moment.
That's right. Exactly.
So how can everyone find you, Lynn? I'm just so grateful that you wrote this memoir and you're doing the workshops. How can everyone find you?
Well, thank you for asking me that question. I actually have two websites. There's www.lynnbarrett.com, and that's spelled LYNBARRETT.com. And on that website, you will find actually a book trailer and some more information about the book. My blog, my weekly blog, is on that website, and a list of, you know, other some of my talks that I've given elsewhere. You can actually listen to them. So and it also has information about the writing workshops. Then I have another website that is just for the writing workshops. And it's called Dissociative Writer, www.dissociativewriters.com. And it tells you how you can become a part of a virtual dissociative writers workshop. I also do teach once a year a memoir writing class for people with dissociative disorders. So those are two places that you can learn more about what I have to offer, and you know, how you can get involved in some way or another.
Lynn, thank you so much for our time today. And today is March 5th. I'm going to launch this interview later, and I feel incredibly grateful that you have shared your healing journey with us. I think we've given people some tips and tools, and I feel like it's so validating when someone can share their story. So thank you for being on the show today. And thank you, everyone. And remember, there's hope. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you so much, Denise.
Thank you.